is in the president's councils. She also touched lightly on her family problems, which she feared might become a distraction. Roosevelt wrote a little squib on a piece of scratch paper and sent it back, "Have considered your advice and don't agree." Perkins's grandmother had told her that when somebody opens a door, you should always walk through. So Perkins confronted FDR with terms if she was to become his labor secretary. If she were to join the cabinet, FDR would have to commit to a broad array of social insurance policies, massive unemployment relief, a giant public works program, minimum wage laws, a social security program for old age insurance, and the abolition of child labor. "I suppose you are going to nag me about this forever," Roosevelt told her. She confirmed she would. Perkins was one of only two top aides to stay with Roosevelt for his entire term as president. She became one of the tireless champions of the New Deal. She was central to the creation of the Social Security system. She was a major force behind many of the New Deal jobs programs, such as the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Federal Works Agency, and the Public Works Administration. Through the Fair Labor Standards Act, she established the nation's first minimum wage law and its first overtime law. She sponsored federal legislation on child labor and unemployment insurance. During World War II, she resisted calls to draft women, sensing that women would benefit more over the long run if they could take the jobs that were being abandoned by drafted men. Perkins excelled at reading Franklin Roosevelt. After he died, Perkins wrote a biographical work, The Roosevelt I Knew, which remains one of the most astute character sketches ever written about the man. Overshadowing all Roosevelt's decisions, Perkins wrote, was his feeling that nothing in human judgment is final. One may courageously take the step that seems right today, because it can be modified tomorrow if it does not work well. He was an improviser, not a planner. He took a step and adjusted, a step and adjusted. Gradually, a big change would emerge. This mentality develops, she continued, in a man who is more an instrument than an engineer. The prophets of Israel would have called him an instrument of the Lord. The prophets of today could only explain his type of mind in terms of psychology, about which they know so pitiably little. Perkins devised a strategy to deal with this man who was prone to changing his mind and shifting direction depending upon who was the last advisor he encountered. Before her meeting with the president, she would prepare a one-page memo outlining the concrete options before him. They would go over her outline and Roosevelt would state his preference. Then Perkins would force him to repeat himself. "Do you authorize me to go ahead with this? Are you sure?" They would have a little more discussion, and then Perkins would underline his decision a second time. "Are you sure you want item number one? Do you want items number two and three? You understand that this is what we do, and this is who is opposed?" The purpose of this exercise was to sear a photograph of the decision into Roosevelt's memory. Then she would ask him a third time, asking him whether he explicitly remembered his decision and understood the opposition he would face. "Is that all right? Is it still okay?" FDR did not always stand up for Perkins when she needed it. He was too slippery a politician to extend loyalty downward all of the time. She was not popular with many of the men in the cabinet. For one thing, she had a tendency to go on at meetings. She was certainly not popular with the press. Her sense of privacy and her fierce desire to protect her husband prevented her from hanging around with reporters or ever letting down her guard. The reporters, in turn, were unsympathetic. As the years went by, she became exhausted by the job. Her reputation waned. Twice she sent Roosevelt a letter of resignation, and twice he rejected it. "Francis, you can't go now. You mustn't put this on me now," Roosevelt pleaded. "I can't think of anybody else. I can't get used to anyone else." "Not now. Do stay there and don't say anything. You are all right. In 1939, she became the target of impeachment proceedings. The case revolved around an Australian longshoreman named Harry Bridges, who led a general strike in San Francisco. Bridges' critics called him a communist and demanded that he be deported for subversive activities. When the Soviet Union fell and the files were opened, it turned out they were right. Bridges was a communist agent known by the code name Rossi. But at the time that wasn't so clear. Deportation hearings operated by the Labor Department dragged on. In 1937, more evidence against Bridges surfaced. And in 1938, the department began proceedings to deport him. These proceedings were blocked by a court decision, which was then appealed to the Supreme Court. The delay inflamed Bridges' critics, which included business groups and the leaders of rival unions. Perkins bore the brunt of their criticism. Why was the Labor Secretary shielding a subversive? One congressman accused her of being a Russian Jew and a communist herself. In January 1939, J. Parnell Thomas of New Jersey introduced impeachment charges against her. The press coverage was brutal. Franklin Roosevelt was given a chance to rise to her defense, but wary of soiling his own reputation by association, he just let her hang out there. Most of her allies in Congress remained silent, too. The Federation of Women's Clubs also refused to defend her. The New York Times wrote an ambiguous editorial. The common sentiment was that she was, in fact, a communist, and nobody wanted to get in the line of fire of those who were persecuting her. It was left to the Tammany Hall Pauls to remain reliably steadfast beside her. Perkins's grandmother had always told her that when social disaster strikes, all are to act as though nothing had happened. Perkins soldiered on. Her description of that period is awkwardly phrased but revealing. Of course, if I had wept at all, or if I'd let myself down at all, I would have disintegrated, Perkins said later. That's the kind of person which we New Englanders are. We disintegrate if we do these things. All the qualities in us of integrity and the ability to keep our heads clear and make decisions and take actions that are influenced by our personal suffering or personal effect on ourselves, that integrity would have been scattered, and I would not have had that inner core within myself which makes it possible for me to rely upon myself under the guidance of God to do the right thing. Put in plain language, Perkins was aware that there was a fragility within herself. If she relaxed the hold she had on herself, then all might fall apart. Over the years, Perkins had made frequent visits to the All Saints Convent in Catonsville, Maryland. She would go to the convent for 2 or 3 days at a time, gathering for prayers 5 times a day, eating simple meals, and tending the gardens. She spent most of those days in silence, and when the nuns came to mop her floor, they sometimes had to mop around her, for she was on her knees in prayer. During the impeachment crisis, Perkins visited the convent whenever she could. "I have discovered the rule of silence is one of the most beautiful things in the world," she wrote to a friend. "It preserves one from the temptation of the idle world, the fresh remark, the wisecrack, the angry challenge. It is really quite remarkable what it does for one." She also reflected on a distinction that had once seemed unimportant to her. When a person gives a poor man shoes, does he do it for the poor man or for God? He should do it for God, she decided. The poor will often be ungrateful, and you will lose heart if you rely on immediate emotional rewards for your work. But if you do it for God, you will never grow discouraged. A person with a deep vocation is not dependent on constant positive reinforcement. The job doesn't have to pay off every month or every year. The person thus called is performing a task because it is intrinsically good, not for what it produces. Finally, on February 8, 1939, Perkins was able to meet her accusers. She appeared before the House Judiciary Committee as it considered articles of impeachment against her. She delivered a long and detailed recitation of the administrative procedures initiated against Bridges, the reasons for them, and the legal constraints preventing further action. The questions ranged from the skeptical to the brutal. When opponents made vicious charges against her, she asked them to repeat their question, believing that no person can be scurrilous twice. The photographs of the hearing make her look haggard and exhausted, but she impressed the committee with her detailed knowledge of the case. Eventually, in March, the committee ruled that there were insufficient facts to support impeachment. She was cleared, but the report was vague and elliptical. It generated little press coverage, and her reputation was permanently marred. Unable to resign, she soldiered on in the administration for another 6 years, helping out mostly behind the scenes. She was stoic about it all, never showing any public weakness or any self-pity. After her government service ended, when she could have written a memoir to give her side of the story, she declined. During the Second World War, she served as an administrative troubleshooter. She urged Roosevelt to do something to help European Jewry. She became alarmed by the way federal action was beginning to infringe on privacy and civil liberties. When FDR died in 1945, she was finally released from the cabinet, though President Truman asked her to serve on the Civil Service Commission. Instead of writing that memoir, she wrote a book about Roosevelt instead. It was a tremendous success, but it contains very little autobiography. Perkins did not really experience private joy until the end of her life. In 1957, a young labor economist asked her to teach a course at Cornell. The job paid about $10,000 a year, scarcely more than she had earned decades before as New York Industrial Commissioner. But she needed the money to pay for her daughter's mental health care. At first, she lived in residential hotels during her time in Ithaca, but she was then invited to live in a small bedroom at Telluride House, a sort of fraternity house for some of Cornell's most gifted students. She was delighted by the invitation. "I feel like a bride on her wedding night," she told friends. While there, she drank bourbon with the boys and tolerated their music at all hours. She attended the Monday house meetings, though she rarely spoke. She gave them copies of Baltasar Gracián's The Art of Worldly Wisdom, a 17th-century guidebook by a Spanish Jesuit priest on how to retain one's integrity while navigating the halls of power. She became close friends with Alan Bloom, a young professor who would go on to achieve fame as the author of The Closing of the American Mind. Some of the boys had trouble understanding how this small, charming, and unassuming old lady could have played such an important historical role. She did not like airplanes and traveled alone by bus, sometimes having to make 4 or 5 connections to get to a funeral or a lecture. She tried to destroy some of her papers to foil future biographers. She traveled with a copy of her will in her handbag, so that if she died, she wouldn't cause any trouble. She died alone in a hospital on May 14, 1965, at age 85. A few of the Telluride House boys served as pallbearers, including Paul Wolfowitz, who would go on to serve in the Reagan and Bush administrations. The minister read the "Be Ye Steadfast" passage from 1 Corinthians that Perkins herself had read upon her graduation from Mount Holyoke College more than 6 decades before. If you look back at her college yearbook photo, you see a small, cute, almost mousy young lady. It would be hard to foresee from that vulnerable expression that she would be able to endure so much hardship, the mental illnesses of her husband and daughter, the ordeal of being the solitary woman in a hyper-masculine world, the decades of political battles and negative press. But it would also be hard to foresee how much she would accomplish throughout the hardship. She faced her own weaknesses, laziness, glibness, early in life, and steeled herself for a life of total commitment. She suppressed her own identity so she could lobby for her cause. She took on every new challenge and remained as steadfast as her motto. She was, as Kirsten Downey would put it in the title of her fine biography, the woman behind the New Deal. On the one hand, she was a fervent liberal activist, of the sort we are familiar with today. But she combined this activism with reticent traditionalism, hesitancy, and a puritanical sensibility. Daring in politics and economics, she was conservative in morality. She practiced a thousand little acts of self-discipline to guard against self-indulgence, self-glorification, or, until the impeachment and the end of her life, self-reflection. Her rectitude and reticence pinched her private life and made her bad at public relations, but it helped her lead a summoned life, a life in service to a vocation. Perkins didn't so much choose her life. She responded to the call of a felt necessity. A person who embraces a calling doesn't take a direct route to self-fulfillment. She is willing to surrender the things that are most dear, and by seeking to forget herself and submerge herself, she finds a purpose that defines and fulfills herself. Such vocations almost always involve tasks that transcend a lifetime. They almost always involve throwing yourself into a historical process. They involve compensating for the brevity of life by finding membership in a historic commitment. As Reinhold Niebuhr put it in 1952, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness." Chapter 3. Self-Conquest. Ida Stover Eisenhower was born in 1862 in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, one of 11 children. Her childhood was more or less a series of catastrophes. When she was a young girl, Union soldiers invaded her home, hunting for her two teenage brothers. They threatened to burn down the barn and ransack the town and surrounding country. Her mother died when Ida was nearly 5, and her father died when she was 11. The children were scattered among distant relations. Ida became the assistant cook for the large household that was putting her up. She baked pies, pastries and meats, darned socks and patched clothing. She was not, however, sad and pitiable. From the start, she had spark and drive and pushed daringly against her hardships. She was an overworked orphan, but folks in town remembered her as something of a tomboy, wiry and unafraid, galloping bareback through town on any borrowed horse, and one time falling and breaking her nose. Girls were generally not educated beyond 8th grade at the time, but Ida, who in early adolescence had memorized 1,365 Bible verses in 6 months on her own, possessed a tremendous drive to improve herself, in both Adam 1 and Adam 2 terms. One day, when she was 15, her host family went off on a family outing, leaving her alone. She packed her belongings and sneaked away, walking to Staunton, Virginia. She got a room and a job and enrolled herself in the local high school. She graduated, taught for 2 years, and at 21 came into a $1,000 inheritance. She used $600 of that, more than $10,000 today, to buy an ebony piano, which was to remain the most treasured possession of her life. The rest she devoted to her education. She hitched on with a Mennonite caravan heading west, though she was not a Mennonite, and settled with her brother at the grandly named Lane University in Lecompton, Kansas. There were 14 freshmen the year Ida matriculated, and classes were held in the parlor of a residential house. Ida studied music. She was, according to faculty reports, not the brightest student, but she was diligent and she earned good grades through hard digging. Her classmates found a joyful, gregarious personality and an extremely optimistic nature, and they elected her valedictorian. She also met her temperamental opposite while at Lane, a dour and stubborn fellow named David Eisenhower. Inexplicably, they fell in love, and they remained together for life. Their children could not remember a serious argument between them, though David gave Ida ample cause. They were married within the River Brethren Church, a small Orthodox sect that believed in plain dress, temperance, and pacifism. After a daring girlhood, Ida devoted herself to a strict, but not too strict, life. The women of the River Brethren sect wore bonnets as part of their religious garb. One day, Ida and a friend decided they no longer wanted to wear the bonnets. They were ostracized at church, forced to sit alone in the back. But eventually they won the day and were readmitted, bonnetless, into the community. Ida was strict in her faith, but fun-loving and humane in practice. David opened a store with a partner named Milton Good near Abilene, Kansas. Later, after the store failed, David told his family that Good had disappeared and stolen all the store's money. That was a face-saving lie, which his sons appeared to believe. The fact is that David Eisenhower was solitary and difficult. He seems to have abandoned the business or had a falling out with his partner. After the business collapsed, David left for Texas, leaving Ida with an infant son at home and another on the way. David's decision to quit the store and abandon his pregnant wife is incomprehensible, the historian Jean Smith writes. He had no job lined up or a profession on which to fall back. David eventually found a job doing manual labor in a railroad yard. Ida followed him to Texas and set up home in a shack along the tracks where Dwight was born. By the time Ida was 28, they'd hit bottom. They had $24.15 in cash and few possessions except the piano back in Kansas, and David had no marketable skills. The extended Eisenhower family came to the rescue. David was offered a job at a creamery in Abilene, and they moved back to Kansas and back to the middle class. Ida raised 5 boys, all of whom would go on to remarkable success and all of whom would spend their lives revering her. Dwight would later call her the finest person I've ever known. In At Ease, the memoir composed late in life, Ike revealed how much he idolized her, though his prose, characteristically, was restrained. Her serenity, her open smile, her gentleness with all and her tolerance of their ways, despite an inflexible religious conviction and her own strict pattern of personal conduct, made even a brief visit with Ida Eisenhower memorable for a stranger. And for her sons, privileged to spend a boyhood in her company, the memories are indelible. There was no drinking, card playing, or dancing in the house. There was not much demonstrated love. Dwight's father was quiet, somber, and inflexible, while Ida was warm and down to earth. But there were Ida's books, her tutelage, and her commitment to education. Dwight became an avid reader of classical history, reading about the battles of Marathon and Salamis, and heroes like Pericles and Themistocles. There was also Ida's vibrant, funny personality, and her maxims, which came in a steady, tough-minded flow. God deals the cards and we play them. Sink or swim. Survive or perish. The family prayed and read the Bible every day, the 5 brothers taking turns and forfeiting the right to be the reader when they stumbled over a line. Though Dwight was not religious later in life, he was steeped in the biblical metaphysic and could cite verses with ease. Ida, though devout herself, strongly believed that religious views were a matter of personal conscience and not to be imposed on others. During Eisenhower's presidential campaigns, Abilene was portrayed as an idyllic Norman Rockwell piece of rural America. In reality, it was a harsh environment covered by a thick coat of respectability and propriety. Abilene had gone from boomtown to Bible Belt, from whorehouses to schoolmarms, without any of the intervening phases. Victorian morality was reinforced by Puritan rigor, what one historian has called Augustinianism come to America. Ida began raising her boys in a house Ike would later calculate to be about 833 square feet. Thrift was essential. Self-discipline, a daily lesson. Before modern medicine, with sharp tools and hard physical labor to be done, there was a greater chance of accidents and more catastrophic consequences when they came. One year, an invasion of grasshoppers ruined the crops. Dwight suffered a leg infection as a teenager and refused to let the doctors amputate because it would have ended his football career. He slipped in and out of consciousness and had one of his brothers sleep on the threshold of his room to prevent the doctor from cutting off the leg while Ike was asleep. Once, when Dwight was babysitting his 3-year-old brother Earl, he left a pocket knife open on a windowsill. Earl got up on a chair, tried to grasp the knife, but it slipped from his hands and plunged into his eye, damaging the eye and producing a lifelong sense of guilt in Dwight. Somebody should write a history of how the common death of children shaped culture and beliefs. It must have created a general sense that profound suffering was not far off, that life was fragile and contained unbearable hardships. After Ida lost one son, Paul, she converted to the sect that would later become the Jehovah's Witnesses, in search of a more personal and compassionate expression of faith. Eisenhower himself would later lose his own firstborn son, Dowd Dwight, known in the family as Icky, an experience that darkened his world ever after. "This was the greatest disappointment and disaster in my life," he would write decades later, "the one I have never been able to forget completely. Today, when I think of it, even now as I write about it, the keenness of our loss comes back to me as fresh and terrible as it was in that long, dark day soon after Christmas, 1920. The fragility and remorselessness of this life demanded a certain level of discipline. If a single slip could produce disaster, with little in the way of a social safety net to cushion the fall, if death or drought or disease or betrayal could come crushingly at any moment, then character and discipline were paramount requirements. This was the shape of life, an underlying condition of peril, covered by an ethos of self-restraint, reticence, temperance, and self-wariness, all designed to minimize the risks. People in that culture developed a moral abhorrence of anything that might make life even more perilous, like debt or childbirth out of wedlock. They developed a stern interest in those activities that might harden resilience. Any child raised by Ida Eisenhower was going to value education, but the general culture placed much less emphasis on it than ours does now. Of the 200 children who entered first grade with Dwight in 1897, only 31 graduated with him from high school. Academics were less important because you could get a decent job without a degree. What mattered more to long-term stability and success was having steady habits, the ability to work, the ability to sense and ward off sloth and self-indulgence. In that environment, a disciplined work ethic really was more important than a brilliant mind. One Halloween evening, when he was about 10, Eisenhower's older brothers received permission to go out trick-or-treating, a more adventurous activity in those days than it is now. Ike wanted to go with them, but his parents told him he was too young. He pleaded with them, watched his brothers go, and then became engulfed by uncontrolled rage. He turned red, his hair bristled. Weeping and screaming, he rushed out into the front yard and began pounding his fists against the trunk of an apple tree, scraping the skin off and leaving his hands bloody and torn. His father shook him, lashed him with a hickory switch, and sent him up to bed. About an hour later, with Ike sobbing into his pillow, his mother came up and sat silently rocking in the chair next to his bed. Eventually she quoted a verse from the Bible, "He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city." As she began to salve and bandage his wounds, She told her son to beware the anger and hatred burning inside. Hatred is a futile thing, she told him, which only injures the person who harbors it. Of all her boys, she told him, he had the most to learn about controlling his passions. When he was 76, Eisenhower wrote, I have always looked back on that conversation as one of the most valuable moments of my life. To my youthful mind, it seemed to me that she talked for hours, but I suppose the affair was ended in 15 or 20 minutes. At least she got me to acknowledge that I was wrong, and I felt enough ease in my mind to fall off to sleep. That concept, conquering your own soul, was a significant one in the moral ecology in which Eisenhower grew up. It was based on the idea that deep inside we are dual in our nature. We are fallen, but also splendidly endowed. We have a side to our nature that is sinful, selfish, deceiving, and self-deceiving, but we have another side to our nature that is in God's image, that seeks transcendence and virtue. The essential drama of life is the drama to construct character, which is an engraved set of disciplined habits, a settled disposition to do good. The cultivation of Adam II was seen as a necessary foundation for Adam I to flourish. Sin. Today, the word sin has lost its power and awesome intensity. It's used most frequently in the context of fattening desserts. Most people in daily conversation don't talk much about individual sin. If they talk about human evil at all, that evil is most often located in the structures of society, in inequality, oppression, racism, and so on, not in the human breast. We've abandoned the concept of sin first because we've left behind the depraved view of human nature. In the 18th and even the 19th century, many people really did embrace the dark self-estimation expressed in the old Puritan prayer, Yet I sin. Eternal Father, Thou art good beyond all thought, but I am vile, wretched, miserable, blind. That's simply too much darkness for the modern mentality. Second, in many times and many places, the word sin was used to declare war on pleasure, even on the healthy pleasures of sex and entertainment. Sin was used as a pretext to live joylessly and censoriously. Sin was a word invoked to suppress the pleasures of the body, to terrify teenagers about the perils of masturbation. Furthermore, the word sin was abused by the self-righteous, by dry-hearted scolds who seem alarmed, as H.L. Mencken put it, by the possibility that someone, somewhere, might be enjoying himself, who always seem ready to rap somebody's knuckles with a ruler on the supposition that that person is doing wrong. The word sin was abused by people who embraced a harsh and authoritarian style of parenting, who felt they had to beat the depravity out of their children. It was abused by those who, for whatever reason, fetishize suffering, who believe that only through dure self-mortification can you really become superior and good. But in truth, sin, like vocation and soul, is one of those words that it is impossible to do without. It is one of those words, and there will be many in this book, that have to be reclaimed and modernized. Sin is a necessary piece of our mental furniture, because it reminds us that life is a moral affair. No matter how hard we try to reduce everything to deterministic brain chemistry, no matter how hard we try to reduce behavior to the sort of herd instinct that is captured in big data, no matter how hard we strive to replace sin with non-moral words like mistake or error or weakness, the most essential parts of life are matters of individual responsibility and moral choice. Whether to be brave or cowardly, honest or deceitful, compassionate or callous, faithful or disloyal. When modern culture tries to replace sin with ideas like error or insensitivity, or tries to banish words like virtue, character, evil, and vice altogether, that doesn't make life any less moral. It just means we have obscured the inescapable moral core of life with shallow language. It just means we think and talk about these choices less clearly, and thus become increasingly blind to the moral stakes of everyday life. Sin is also a necessary piece of our mental furniture because sin is communal, while error is individual. You make a mistake, but we are all plagued by sins like selfishness and thoughtlessness. Sin is baked into our nature and is handed down through the generations. We are all sinners together. To be aware of sin is to feel intense sympathy toward others who sin. It is to be reminded that, as the plight of sin is communal, so the solutions are communal. We fight sin together as communities and families, fighting our own individual sins by helping others fight theirs. Furthermore, the concept of sin is necessary because it is radically true. To say you are a sinner is not to say that you have some black, depraved stain on your heart. It is to say that, like the rest of us, you have some perversity in your nature. We want to do one thing, but we end up doing another. We want what we should not want. None of us wants to be hard-hearted, but sometimes we are. No one wants to self-deceive, but we rationalize all the time. No one wants to be cruel, but we all blurt things out and regret them later. No one wants to be a bystander, to commit sins of omission, but, in the words of the poet Marguerite Wilkinson, we all commit the sin of unattempted loveliness. We really do have dappled souls. The same ambition that drives us to build a new company also drives us to be materialistic and to exploit. The same lust that leads to children leads to adultery. The same confidence that can lead to daring and creativity can lead to self-worship and arrogance. Sin is not some demonic thing. It's just our perverse tendency to fuck things up, to favor the short term over the long term, the lower over the higher. Sin, when it is committed over and over again, hardens into loyalty to a lower love. The danger of sin, in other words, is that it feeds on itself. Small moral compromises on Monday make you more likely to commit other bigger moral compromises on Tuesday. A person lies to himself and soon can no longer distinguish when he is lying to himself and when he isn't. Another person is consumed by the sin of self-pity, a passion to be a righteous victim that devours everything around it as surely as anger or greed. People rarely commit the big sins out of the blue. They walk through a series of doors. They have an unchecked problem with anger. They have an unchecked problem with drinking or drugs. They have an unchecked problem of sympathy. Corruption breeds corruption. Sin is the punishment of sin. The final reason sin is a necessary part of our mental furniture is that without it, the whole method of character building dissolves. From time immemorial, people have achieved glory by achieving great external things, but they have built character by struggling against their internal sins. People become solid, stable, and worthy of self-respect because they have defeated or at least struggled with their own demons. If you take away the concept of sin, then you take away the thing the good person struggles against. The person involved in the struggle against sin understands that each day is filled with moral occasions. I once met an employer who asks each job applicant, "Describe a time when you told the truth and it hurt you." He is essentially asking those people if they have their loves in the right order, if they would put love of truth above love of career. In places like Abilene, Kansas, the big sins, left unchallenged, would have had very practical and disastrous effects. Sloth could lead to a failure of a farm, gluttony and inebriation to the destruction of a family, lust to the ruination of a young woman, vanity to excessive spending, debt, and bankruptcy. In places like that, people had an awareness not only of sin, but of the different kinds of sins and the different remedies for each. Some sins, such as anger and lust, are like wild beasts. They have to be fought through habits of restraint. Other sins, such as mockery and disrespect, are like stains. They can be expunged only by absolution, by apology, remorse, restitution, and cleansing. Still others, such as stealing, are like a debt. They can be rectified only by repaying what you owe to society. Sins such as adultery, bribery, and betrayal are more like treason than like crime. They damage the social order. Social harmony can be rewoven only by slowly recommitting to relationships and rebuilding trust. The sins of arrogance and pride arise from a perverse desire for status and superiority. The only remedy for them is to humble oneself before others. In other words, people in earlier times inherited a vast moral vocabulary and set of moral tools, developed over centuries and handed down from generation to generation. This was a practical inheritance, like learning how to speak a certain language, which people could use to engage their own moral struggles. Character. Ida Eisenhower was funny and warm-hearted, but stood sentry against backsliding. She forbade dancing and card games and drinking in her home precisely because her estimation of the power of sin was so high. Since self-control is a muscle that tires easily, it is much better to avoid temptation in the first place rather than try to resist it once it arises. In raising her boys, she showed them bottomless love and warmth. She allowed them more freedom to get into scrapes than parents generally do today. But she did demand that they cultivate the habit of small, constant self-repression. Today, when we say that somebody is repressed, we tend to mean it as a criticism. It means they are uptight, stiff, or unaware of their true emotional selves. That's because we live in a self-expressive culture. We tend to trust the impulses inside the self and distrust the forces outside the self that seek to push down those impulses. But in this earlier moral ecology, people tended to distrust the impulses inside the self. These impulses could be restrained, they argued, through habit. In 1877, the psychologist William James wrote a short treatise called Habit. When you are trying to lead a decent life, he wrote, you want to make your nervous system your ally and not your enemy. You want to engrave certain habits so deep that they will become natural and instinctual. James wrote that when you set out to engrave a habit, say, going on a diet or always telling the truth, you want to launch yourself with as strong and decided an initiative as possible. Make the beginning of a new habit a major event in your life. Then, never suffer an exception until the habit is firmly rooted in your life. A single slip undoes many fine acts of self-control. Then take advantage of every occasion to practice your habit. Practice a gratuitous exercise of self-discipline every day. Follow arbitrary rules. Asceticism of this sort is like the insurance which a man pays on his house of goods. The tax does him no good at the time, and may possibly never bring him a return. But if the fire does come, his having paid it will be his salvation from ruin. What William James and Ida Eisenhower were trying to inculcate in their different ways was steadiness over time. Character, as the Yale law professor Anthony T. Cronman has put it, is an ensemble of settled dispositions, of habitual feelings and desires. The idea is largely Aristotelian. If you act well, eventually you will be good. Change your behavior, and eventually you rewire your brain. Ida emphasized the importance of practicing small acts of self-control, following the rules of etiquette when sitting at the table, dressing in one's Sunday best when going to church, keeping the Sabbath afterward, using formal diction in letter writing as a display of deference and respect, eating plain food, avoiding luxury. If you are in the army, keep your uniform neat and your shoes polished. If you are at home, keep everything tidy. Practice the small outward disciplines. In the culture of that time, people also believed that manual labor was a school for character. In Abilene, everybody from business owners to farmers did physical labor every day, greasing the buggy axles, shoveling coal, sifting the unburned lumps from the stove ash. Eisenhower grew up in a home with no running water, and the boys' chores began at dawn, waking up at 5 to build the morning fire, hauling water from the well, and continued through the day, carrying a hot lunch to their father at the creamery, feeding the chickens, canning up to 500 quarts of fruit annually, boiling the clothing on wash day, raising corn to be sold for spending money, digging trenches when plumbing became available, and wiring the house when electricity came to town. Ike grew up in an atmosphere that is almost the inverse of the way many children are raised today. Today's children are spared most of the manual labor Dwight had to perform, but they are not given nearly as much leeway to roam over forests and town when the chores were done. Dwight had a great deal of assigned work, but also a great deal of freedom to roam around town. David Eisenhower, Dwight's father, practiced this sort of disciplined life in a harsh and joyless way. He was defined by his punctilious sense of rectitude. He was rigid, cool, and strictly proper. After his bankruptcy, he had a horror of taking on any debt, of slipping even a bit. When he was a manager at his company, he forced his employees to save 10% of their salary every month. They had to report to him what they had done with their 10%, either putting it in the bank or investing it in stocks. He wrote down each answer each month, and if he was not satisfied with their report, they lost their job. He seemed never to relax, never taking his boys out hunting or fishing or playing with them much at all. He was an inflexible man with a stern code, one of the boys, Edgar, was to recall. Life to him was a very serious proposition, and that's the way he lived it, soberly and with due reflection. Ida, on the other hand, always had a smile on her lips. She was always willing to be a little naughty, to violate her sense of rectitude, even taking a shot of alcohol if the situation warranted. Ida seemed to understand, as her husband did not, that you can't rely just on self-control, habit, work, and self-denial to build character. Your reason and your will are simply too weak to defeat your desires all the time. Individuals are strong, but they are not self-sufficient. To defeat sin, you need help from outside. Her character-building method had a tender side as well. Fortunately, love is the law of our nature. People like Ida understand that love, too, is a tool to build character. The tender character-building strategy is based on the idea that we can't always resist our desires, but we can change and reorder our desires by focusing on our higher loves. Focus on your love for your children. Focus on your love of country. Focus on your love for the poor and downtrodden. Focus on your love of your hometown or alma mater. To sacrifice for such things is sweet. It feels good to serve your beloved. Giving becomes cheerful giving because you are so eager to see the things you love prosper and thrive. Pretty soon you are behaving better. The parent focusing on the love of his or her children will drive them to events day after day, will get up in the middle of the night when they are sick, will drop everything when they are in crisis. The lover wants to sacrifice, to live life as an offering. A person motivated by such feelings will be a bit less likely to sin. Ida demonstrated that it is possible to be strict and kind, disciplined and loving, to be aware of sin and also aware of the possibility of forgiveness, charity, and mercy. Decades later, when Dwight Eisenhower took the presidential oath of office, Ida asked him to have the Bible opened to 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. The most powerful way to fight sin is by living in a sweet, loving way. It's how you do the jobs you do, whether it's a prestigious job or not. As others have noted, God loves adverbs. Self-control. Dwight seems to have belonged to the category of those who believe that religion is good for society, but who are not religious themselves. There's no evidence that he had an explicit sense of God's grace or any theological thoughts about redemption. But he inherited both his mother's garrulous nature and her sense that that nature had to be continually repressed and conquered. He just held these beliefs in secular form. He was rambunctious from birth. His childhood was remembered in Abilene for a series of epic brawls. At West Point he was defiant, rebellious, and misbehaving. He ran up a string of demerits for gambling, smoking, and general disrespectfulness. At graduation, he ranked 125th out of 164 men for discipline. Once he was demoted from sergeant to private for dancing too exuberantly at a ball. He was also bedeviled throughout his military career and his presidency with the barely suppressed temper that his parents had seen on that Halloween evening. Throughout his military career, his subordinates came to look for the telltale signs of his looming fury, such as certain set expressions that signaled an imminent profanity-laced explosion. Dubbed the terrible-tempered Mr. Bang by a World War II journalist, Eisenhower's capacity for rage was always there, just under the surface. It was like looking into a Bessemer furnace, one of his aides, Bryce Harlow, recalled. His wartime doctor, Howard Snyder, noticed the twisted, cord-like temple arteries standing out on the side of his head, just before one of Eisenhower's explosions. Ike's subordinates were awed by his capacity for rage, his biographer, Evan Thomas, wrote. Eisenhower's appointments secretary, Tom Stevens, noticed that the president tended to wear brown whenever he was in a foul temper. Stevens would see Eisenhower from the office window. "Brown suit today," he would call out to the staff as forewarning. Ike was even more divided than most of us. He was a master of army expletives, but he almost never cursed in front of women. He would turn away if someone told a dirty joke. He was reprimanded at West Point for habitually smoking cigarettes in the halls, and by the end of the war he was a four-pack-a-day smoker. But one day he quit cold turkey. "I simply gave myself an order." Freedom, he would later say in his 1957 State of the Union address, has been defined as the opportunity for self-discipline. His internal torment could be convulsive. By the end of World War II, his body was a collection of aches and pains. He spent the nights staring at the ceiling, racked by insomnia and anxiety, drinking and smoking, tortured by throat infections, cramps, spiking blood pressure. But his capacity for self-repression, what might be called noble hypocrisy, was also immense. He was not naturally good at hiding his emotions. He had a remarkably expressive face. But day by day, he put on a false front of confident ease and farm boy garrulousness. He became known for his sunny, boyish temperament. Evan Thomas writes that Ike told his grandson, David, that that smile came not from some sunny feel-good philosophy, but from getting knocked down by a boxing coach at West Point. "If you can't smile when you get up from a knockdown," the coach said, "you're never going to lick an opponent." He thought it was necessary to project easy confidence in order to lead the army and win the war. "I firmly determined that my mannerisms and speech in public would always reflect the cheerful certainty of victory, that any pessimism and discouragement I might ever feel would be reserved for my pillow. To translate this conviction into tangible results, I adopted a policy of circulating through the whole force to the full limit imposed by physical considerations. I did my best to meet everyone from general to private with a smile, a pat on the back, and a definite interest in his problems." He devised stratagems for dismissing his true passions. For example, in his diaries he made lists of people who offended him as a way of sealing off his anger toward them. When he felt a surge of hatred, he refused to let it rule him. Anger cannot win. It cannot even think clearly, he noted in his diary. Other times he would write an offender's name on a piece of paper and then drop it into the wastebasket, another symbolic purging of emotion. Eisenhower was not an authentic man. He was a passionate man who lived, as much as his mother did, under a system of artificial restraints. Organization Man. Ida sent Ike off from Abilene to West Point on June 8, 1911. She remained an ardent pacifist, determinedly opposed to the soldier's vocation, but she told her son, "It is your choice." She saw the train off, went home, and shut herself in her room. The remaining boys could hear her sobbing through the door. His brother Milton later told Ike it was the first time he had ever heard their mother cry. Ike graduated from West Point in the class of 1915. He thus spent his early career in the shadow of World War I. Trained for combat, he never saw action in the war that was supposed to end all wars. He never even left the United States. He spent those years training troops, coaching football, and doing logistics. He lobbied furiously to be sent to war, and in October 1918, when he was 28, he received orders. He was to ship out to France on November 18th. The war, of course, ended on November 11th. It was a bitter blow. "I suppose we'll spend the rest of our lives explaining why we didn't get into this war," he lamented in a letter to a fellow officer. Then he made an uncharacteristically unrestrained vow. "By God, from now on I am cutting myself a swath that will make up for this." That vow didn't immediately come true. Eisenhower was promoted to lieutenant colonel in 1918, in advance of his coming deployment. He would not be promoted again for 20 years, until 1938. The Army had a glut of officers who'd been elevated during the war, and there were not many openings for advancement in an army that by the 1920s was shrinking and assuming a marginal role in American life. His career stagnated, while the careers of his civilian brothers zoomed ahead. By the time he was in his 40s, he was easily the least accomplished of the boys in the Eisenhower family. He was in middle age. He did not receive his first star until he was 51. Nobody expected great things of him. During these interwar years, Ike served as an infantry officer, football coach, and staff officer, intermittently attending school at the Infantry Tank School, the Command and General Staff School, and eventually the War College. Ike would occasionally unleash his frustration at the bureaucratic bungling of his institution, at the way it smothered his opportunities and wasted his talents. But on the whole, his response was amazingly restrained. He became the classic organization man. From Ida's rules of conduct, Ike slid easily into the military code of conduct. He subsumed his own desires for the sake of the group. He wrote in one of his memoirs that by the time he was in his 30s, he had learned the basic lesson of the military, that the proper place for a soldier is where he is ordered by his superiors. He was given a run-of-the-mill assignment. "I found no better cure than to blow off steam in private and then settle down to the job at hand." As a staff officer, never a coveted or glamorous role, Eisenhower learned to master procedure, process, teamwork, and organization. He learned the secrets of thriving within the organization. "When I go to a new station, I look to see who is the strongest and ablest man on the post. I forget my own ideas and do everything in my power to promote what he says is right." Later, in At Ease, he wrote, "Always try to associate yourself closely and learn as much as you can from those who know more than you, who do better than you, who see more clearly than you." He was a fanatic about both preparation and then adaptation. "The plans are nothing, but the planning is everything," he would say, or, "Rely on planning, but never trust plans." He also gained a perspective on himself. He began carrying around an anonymous little poem. Take a bucket, fill it with water. Put your hand in, clear up to the wrist. Now pull it out. The hole that remains is a measure of how much you'll be missed. The moral of this quaint example, to do just the best that you can, be proud of yourself, but remember, there is no indispensable man.